Hi, I'm Chris Marie. I'm so glad you're listening. In conflict, do you ever walk on eggshells, avoid sharing your honest opinion, or even hesitate to say no? Well, no more. Susan and I created a Speak Up Kit just for you. It's an easy-to-use, proven step-by-step process to find your voice and reduce your stress. To learn more, go to thriveinc.com/speak up. That's www.thriveinc.com/speakup. Hi, I'm Chris Marie Gamble.
And I'm Susan Clark.
And today we have Carl Purcell, who is a senior behavioral scientist with Irrational Labs. He holds an MSc in behavioral science from the University of Stirling in Ireland and founded Ireland's first behavioral science unit and recently moved to sunny San Diego to work for Irrational Labs. Irrational Labs is a behavioral science consulting firm that works with product and marketing teams of companies like Google, Fidelity, Lyft, Uber, Aetna, Kuna Mutual, and One Medical to drive growth and engagement. Irrational Labs' method and 3D process helps companies understand their customers' needs and design products that solve them for human betterment. Hopefully we got cute. Is it Kuna Mutual? Did I say that right?
That's right.
Okay, good. I haven't heard of them. I heard of everybody else on the list. That is awesome.
Yes.
And what an interesting name, Irrational Labs.
It's
kind of like conflict.
Yeah.
So, Carl, can you even tell us how you got interested in behavioral science?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it all started a bit of a long time ago now, maybe 15 years ago, when I was on holidays and I was reading a book called Nudge by Richard Thaler and Kat Sunstein, very famous book for most behavioral scientists. And really what that book outlines is that our choices and the choices that we make and very substantial, impactful choices, like whether we get a pension or not, the type of will that we want to leave behind, or the healthcare decisions that we make, are not just influenced by rational decision-making factors where we sit down and we think about the cost and the time and the effort, but also by situational factors, by things like, what was the default option in the first place? Do we just stick with that? Most often we do. Or what are other people doing around us? We tend to follow the behavior of others, even if it would be better for us to do something slightly different. And this just really captivated me. I think it really fit with my model of understanding how the world works, much so compared to traditional economics, right? That we're only motivated by information, rationality, and incentives. And yeah, I think once I'd read that book and finished it, I was convinced. And then I was on my way and I went and undertook my master's, and the rest is history, as they say.
That is a great book, Nudge. I think it was a precursor to the one that we switched. Was that the one that the two guys wrote about different behavioral pieces? How to help people change. But I remember Nudge from my university day.
Yeah.
I'm older than that. So let me just say.
I was thinking about the old economic theory that the markets are rational. And my aunt, Bernadette Murphy, was a technical analysis, which everybody snubbed their nose, like quants or quantitative people are the good ones. But she looked at trends, and it's so much more like our brain is 95% subconscious and associative. So it's no wonder markets are not rational. People are not rational. So it makes perfect sense that how we're making decisions, we think and we may justify after making the decision. But what's really a lot of subconscious stuff, I would imagine, tell me where I'm wrong, that's really driving our decision making.
I think you're right. And there's a lot in our environment that shapes our behavior. And I think this speaks to one of the key differences in what behavioral science is and some of the work that we do with clients that might be different to, say, usability testing. You mentioned some people rationalize after the fact, right? I think this is like a common symptom that we see when people do things like focus groups or usability studies. Those studies are very useful. They can give you a sense of what people are thinking, or at least are telling you they're thinking when they're reviewing a product or going through a service. And that can be really useful when you're moving into an area where you really don't know anything, right? Where you're just trying to get the lay of the land. But the type of studies that we do as behavioral scientists at Irrational Labs is we try and say, let's run a structured experiment in a way that we can actually identify what are the real factors that are driving people's behavior. So we'll run like a quantified, randomized study with a large number of people in it, where we'll experimentally manipulate what we're showing different people and then test how that changes their behavior. So to give you like a concrete example of that, we were working with a company called Steady, who they want to help gig workers manage their money better. And one thing that they need to do to help them do that is to get them to link their bank account. But it's a tricky process, right? It's like full of friction. It's not exactly fun to sit down and link your bank account. And so they had some really good ideas about how to do this. One was maybe we could ask them to make a forced choice. So instead of saying you can skip this, you have to at least make a decision, right? So you have to either say accept or decline. Or another way to do this would be to say, what if we say that you're missing some information? So we play to people's kind of completeness bias, right? We don't like tasks that are unfinished. So we tell people your account profile is not set up yet. And then we ran this experiment with them to see what would happen. What we saw was the most successful version, which was this kind of idea of playing into this completeness bias, the fact that we want to finish tasks, increased bank account linking by 125%.
Wow.
And it's super interesting, right? And that's not something you can learn through asking people to sit down in a focus room or at a focus group room and explain to you what they're doing. I think this is like the secret sauce of what behavioral science is and why it's so effective for learning.
And it also, though, explains to me how come now, anytime I sign up for something, there are all those screens that say your profile is incomplete. It hasn't really worked on me yet, but I now understand why it's become such a big part.
Absolutely. You see it all around you once you start to see this stuff.
Yes.
I was buying a used car. So I was using this app. I just Googled it and to see if the car had been in any accidents. It's called Bumper. And I filled in all the stuff, the VIN number and all that. And then it got to, okay, you have accept or decline. Basically, you have to pay $1 or $5. And I'm like, I don't want to actually put up. So I just said, I'm just going to ignore it.
I think that's a good point too. A lot of the time when we were on focus groups, we have a small sample, right? So we only get to talk to 5, 10, 15 people. But rightly, as you say, there's a lot of variance between people, right? You might look at that and say, I'm okay, actually, I'm going to exit out. But when we run these larger experiments, we can generalize across a big bunch of people and see, okay, like on average, is making people make a decision more effective than not?
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like it is.
It can be in a lot of different scenarios. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I love that. And I was thinking about it. I think you said one of your clients was Google. And I like this idea of these experiments because I can't remember the name of Google's books about teams and things like that. But so many of their stories in those sounds like very similar types of stories that they got to about what works for developing team behaviors, even in various situations. I like that. I think they took two teams and they do, this team's going to do that because they both have great ideas and then pull from that behavioral information to layout to the world about teams. So I think we are reading a book.
We're going to interview him, Oscar. Can't remember his name, last name, but he wrote a book on deep listening.
Yeah.
And he has a podcast, Deep Listening, in case anybody wants to Google him. But he definitely, so I want to have you talk about your three B's because in his language, so here I'm reading his book and then I'm reading your stuff and the whole behavior, I think it's behaviors, barriers, and benefits, right?
That's right.
These are the barriers. We researched what are the barriers to listening. And it was attention, it was empathy, and it was a concentration. Those were the three barriers. So they must have done something, applying some sort of behavioral.
Yeah.
Tell me where I'm wrong or talk about that.
No, you're absolutely right. I think what we tried to do with our 3B method is come up with a consistent process that gets at these deeper insights, right? That try and give us an understanding of what it is that's either enabling someone to do something or stopping them from taking the action that you want. So you got it exactly right. The three B's are, the first is to identify a key behavior. So what is it specifically, concretely, that you want the user to do? So maybe we can take an example of a project that we did with TikTok where we were working to reduce the sharing of misinformation. And so if you liked, their big outcome was like, we have this issue with misinformation being shared on the platform and we need to try and reduce how much misinformation people are coming across and how often it's being shared. We said, okay, let's get really specific here and say, what would be the biggest impact? If we could change like one thing from people doing something so that they weren't doing it anymore, what would have the biggest impact on this? And what we came up with our key behavior in that case was stopping people when they hit the share button on TikTok, trying to stop people from actually sharing that piece of misinformation. So if it's been labeled as misinformation, then they back down and they say, actually, you know what? I've now noticed that this is misinformation. I won't share this. And the way then that we figured out, how can we actually do that, right? So now we know what we want to do, but how do we do it? Feeds into the next two steps. So identifying the barriers and the benefit. So identifying the barriers was key. So trying to understand what might stop someone from engaging with a piece of content that's flagged as misinformation, realizing that's the case, and then moving forward. And one thing that we noticed was that often when you're on TikTok, if you think about it, it's a super fast platform, right? You're scrolling very quickly, you're skipping videos. I think the average watch time on TikTok is something like 15 to 30 seconds. People aren't making like these deep evaluative judgments on what they're sharing and what not, and what they're not. And so we said, maybe one thing we could do is help people slow down a little bit. What if when they click the share button, we interrupt them a little bit and we just show them a prompt screen that says, are you sure you want to share this? Just an extra little check. If you want to share it, that's no problem. You can click share anyway, but let's just slow down for a second and think. And so in that case, that was an example where adding in a barrier actually was beneficial. A lot of the times you're trying to remove friction, remove barriers. And then finally, our identify benefits is really trying to think about what are the reasons that someone might want to engage in this behavior, or in this case, might not want to share this information. And so one of the things that we investigated in some pre-experiments that we did for this particular problem that we're working on with TikTok was, can we show people like why it's important not to share misinformation? So can we talk about like the negative potential harms of it? And so if you don't share it, that you're actively protecting the integrity of the platform and contributing to society in a positive way. That was like a benefit that we talked about. And when we ran this experiment in the end, what we found the most effective thing to do was to actually use a barrier in this case, was to slow people down. And when we did that, we reduced shares of misinformation by 24%, which is a very big effect for our field. So we were delighted to work on that with TikTok in that case.
Well, I was thinking, yeah, because I bet you're thinking, I was thinking I could be one thing that might help me not share misinformation is I become, if I have a trust score, all of a sudden, my credibility is dependent and it's about me. I'm like, whoa, versus people who trying to pull on their heartstrings. Hey, you want to do a good thing, that we're pretty self-focused. But if it's going to look bad for me, I don't want to share misinformation.
I think you're right. Yeah.
I think there still might be some work with TikTok on that one. So you could probably add this to the mix.
Our work is never done. Yeah, as behavioral scientists.
Not when it comes to social media either. There's always opportunities. But,
you know. I was thinking, so a lot of yours are around technology and slowing down enough to and investing in experiments. I think a lot of startups, you have pretty big organizations. A lot of these leaner startups are like, we're just going to throw spaghetti on the wall. We're going to keep going.
Yeah.
And they don't slow down to do experiments. We have one client who's even trying to get their own organization to dog food, and there's barriers because there's problems, blah, blah, blah. And it would be great if they use this methodology to slow it down, figure out how, because it's going to help with their clients as well.
Absolutely. I agree. I think it kind of changes when you work with companies at different scales, just how you take the approach. So when we work with some of the larger companies, sometimes we're very lucky and fortunate that they have big testing infrastructure built already. It's really simple for these to run these big experiments. And that's great for us, right? We get a real good, solid field test of whether our intervention has worked or not. But working with smaller clients or like startups, like you mentioned, I think there are other opportunities. You can do what we call out of product testing. So sometimes we'll run like online experiments where we'll try and replicate the startup screens as much as is possible, right? So imagine you're a savings app or something like that. We would take your screens, take the mockups, put them into an online experiment, and then run them with like maybe 1,000 people who are representative of the US population. And then let's measure their behavior and see what they actually do. And so that's a way to let smaller companies, startups still benefit from some of the insights that testing can give you without having to worry about building all of this costly infrastructure to actually do it at scale in field in the product.
Right. That.
I was thinking about, as you were talking, just even the idea. So we work with teams around dealing effectively with conflict. And there are these behavioral things that are in the room. If we could get people, like even when you said to pause, slow down, we're not on a screen. We're not, you can't. You could do it in Zoom meetings. You could interrupt it and everybody take a breath. You don't get a choice. You're off. It's muted. Nothing to say matters until you take and see how that works. But I was also thinking, even if you did something around listening, where you did two different things that on the computer, where some two different examples sent it out, audience, and scored how well people listened based upon what was happening on the screen, whether the table was all talking fast and nobody, but another table was reflecting back.
Yes.
And then they had to, who scored higher and being thought which team was more effective or something. And you think people could see the score. You see how much more effective this team is than this team. And it's something like that. So it's interesting thinking about that.
Do you have any from your point of view on how you could interrupt that? Because you're not in a device. There's no device that's stopping you.
Absolutely. Maybe two different examples here, I think, that are interesting. You're right. The great thing about digital technology is it's very easy to change the environment, right? You're just changing a screen. But did some work before with a call center who are having like a retention problem. So I think they had a really high turnover rate of something like 50 to 70% of their employees were leaving within 7 months. And they tried lots of different things, right? They tried incentives, they tried new healthcare benefits, all of this kind of stuff. And like you said, they didn't have the benefit of making like changes to like a digital screen. This was like a physical process in a big, busy call center. What they did was they changed their intake training instead. And so what they were finding was some of the reasons that people were leaving was they weren't feeling like they belonged at the company. They were feeling like they're just another resource, just another call center resource to be utilized. And so what they had been doing before was after you'd finish your standard training that took about an hour, you would also do another hour of training around company identity. So what's our company values? What do we stand for? All of these things, very typical of what a company might do, right? But then what they did was they tested something new with a second group. And they said, what if we shift the focus to be entirely about the employees themselves instead? And what did they want to get out of working here? What are their goals? And what do they hope to master or learn and develop over the time that they're here? What they saw was when they ran this experiment in the real world and just separated these groups, the second group were 250% more likely to stick around at 7 months. And so I think you're right. I think oftentimes it's much easier to make these changes in digital products, but there's definitely ways that we can intervene in the real world, for sure.
I think that's the same idea around my trust credibility on TikTok, if I was a trusted resource, because people really care about themselves. And so rather than, here's our company, so who are you and how can we help you? And all that really shifts. That's pretty powerful. I love that.
Yeah. I've seen that sounds a lot like that. I think that sounds like Zappos. Originally, they learned a lot from actually being able to understand that it's not so much about having people belong to the company and understand it, but helping them really value who they are and what they bring to the company to add value. And I imagine you could go too far either direction. Like if your company just turned to, it's all about this person's identity, but it does help, especially in a call center, bring somebody in because they may not ever have a sense of, do I actually belong to this company or not?
And why? Yeah.
Yes.
This leads to, have you started doing work around like remote? Because so many companies stay remote. And that I think also doesn't create the glue. And I don't know if you've worked with or team behaviors that create the glue in a remote environment.
Yeah, this is a great question. We're actually I think we're basically 100% remote right now with most of our consulting arrangements. So I hear what you're saying. I think you're right. I think you can't replace everything online that you get in person. So as Irrational Labs, we meet up, I think, 3 to 4 times a year for physical retreats where we book like a bunch of Airbnbs that are nearby each other. We basically live together for 3 to 4 days in this like mini commune type setting, which is great. We get to really get to know each other. We have dinner together every night. We do like an activity, like we went boating in Mexico City, which was super fun. So I think you're right. I think there's definitely things you can do. Like you can still have online team building exercises. We found that honestly, working with some of our consulting clients, that being online can be beneficial and that you can just jump on a call whenever. You don't need to jump on a plane and go there. But you're right. There is something special about being in person. And I think it's important to value that too.
Because there is, you can't, after this meeting, we'll just click off. Versus if we were walking out of the room, I might be like, hey, Carl, like, how's the puppy doing? Like, so that creates that connective glue.
Yes.
Help us feel like we matter and we're connected. And I think that's a real struggle for the remote environment, but I do think it's a reality. And I do think there's tons of benefits.
I think you're right. And I think like it comes down to, I'm actually reading this book at the moment. I don't know if you've read it, called The Art of Gathering.
Yeah, we know her. She's great.
Yes.
Oh, great book. Fantastic. But I really like her sense of, or her advice around being purposeful about like, why are you gathering? And design everything around that. And like with our retreat, being behavioral scientists, we can't really help ourselves, but we really try and design our entire retreat around what it is that we're trying to do. And of course, yes, we want to do some stuff like brainstorm some client projects that are coming up, right? There's some kind of meat and potato stuff that has to get done. But the real purpose of why we're gathering is to build those social relationships, to build like the trust, the psychological safety, so that when we're working online, we feel free to share ideas with each other. And so that's why we design this kind of retreat where we live together for an extended period of time. while we do these like team building activities, whether it's boating or doing like physical exercise together, exactly for that reason, to try and build that connection that then when you're offline, or sorry, when you're online later on, that you still feel like you can be honest with each other, jump in with a bit of critique if necessary, all of these things.
That's true. That's great.
Now, even the topic of psychological safety, are there other applications where you've done experiments to support people, whether they're in person or remote, not on the long haul building psychological safety, but in the moment building psychological safety? And could you talk about that?
Absolutely. I don't have a lovely quantified study for you, but I can talk about when I was running a behavioral science team in Ireland. It was myself and two other behavioral scientists. And what was really key, because our team was so small, and what we were doing was we were working in the energy sector, trying to come up with lots of different ideas around how do we get people to install solar panels? How do we get people to purchase electric vehicles? Like big, like important, meaty questions. And because we're such a small team, I really needed to have the full team bought into the idea generation process, needed to make sure that everyone on the team felt like they could pitch an idea that we really could take from the whiteboard all the way to implementation. And so literally when I was working there, I set up a whiteboard session that we'd have for every week where we would do two things. One, I would invite the team to criticize my experiment design, whatever that we were working on at the moment, or I try and build that norm that that's totally what we want. That's how we get better experiments, but also give them a chance to pitch their own ideas and see them like get put up on the whiteboard for prioritization and move forward. And I can't say for sure, but I'm pretty confident that definitely helped our team build that sense of psychological safety. It was much more common for us to say, "Oh, well, that doesn't really make sense in that part of the experiment. I would do it this way." And then say, "Oh, actually, you know what? You're right. That's true."
I want to take this a little further because I think this is such a big topic, this idea of psychological safety. In my own experience of reading through your process, because I was reading, I don't know which handout.
I printed them all.
For me to look at. Because that actually was one I was actually thinking about. Because you have a very elaborate mind mapping. So I would imagine if right now, with all of the emphasis on DEI, inclusion, all these types of things, trying to really nail down, because what I took from what I read was you really have to be very clear about the behavior that you're trying to
change.
Yeah. And I think sometimes right now, indeed, there was an expectation that may have been, it's like too quantitative without actually looking back and say, what are we actually trying to do? Because if we just put somebody into, we increase our diversity numbers, that actually doesn't mean anything.
Right.
It necessarily lead to inclusion or the felt sense of belonging that you're
right. If I was trying to work, like I would really try to be like, so the behavior might be, if I broke it down, like I want someone who comes into our company there might be a retention element to it, not just for the diversity candidate, but for everyone. So there'd be that behavior. Then there would be, okay, this person who, if we do have a diversity candidate, do they stay? Like different, you
or
really have to break it down.
Do speak up or do people make room? It would really be how to slow down the people that have power in the room and make more space for the people that don't. And how do you, so that you get the slowing down and the backing up and the coming forward of the right types of people?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you want diversity and inclusion at all stages there. You want, obviously, people to have the opportunity to enter the company, to perform in their role, but also exactly to say, if we think about it in terms of behaviors, do these other things like feel free to speak up or to criticize in a healthy, constructive way when necessary. And I think that is, I think psychological safety is a key part of that, right? It is like, how do you build that in a team? How do you get the diversity of thought as well? It's building a safe environment where people feel safe to say, yes, I agree with that for X reason, or no, I don't for Y reason.
I think, though, interesting when you went through that, I think the piece that's missing is that I think everyone I've talked to wants people to speak up and say when it's uncomfortable. But what they don't want is they don't measure, did we actually have the pain point you have to get to the other side? Like, people have to be able to be angry. People have to be able to be both sides of that equation. And that part gets skipped over when you're like, we want people to feel like they can speak up and it's safe. It's not going to feel safe in that moment of, have a moment where I don't feel safe when I hang in. And I think sometimes that's a piece that doesn't get measured.
Like tolerating the discomfort of, I'm about to say something that you're not going to.
Yeah. And it's somehow, that's a,
I feel like it's like the difference between a micro safety and a macro safety, right? The micro safety is, yeah, every single interaction we have is like totally polite and I feel like totally comfortable. And this macro safety is, no, I feel safe even when we do have that disagreement and we, let's say, get a little bit vocal with each other, whatever it is, that ultimately at the end of the day, I know that's going to be fine. So for example, when I was working in the Sustainable Energy Authority back in Ireland, I had one team member in particular who could get quite passionate about things. He would feel that's just like the wrong experiment design, but you express that more as your experiment design doesn't make sense, right? But we could work through that knowing that, hey, really, we're both working towards the same goal. At the end of the day, we want this experiment to be designed as robustly as possible. And ultimately, I know that we respect each other. And so we could get through those moments of discomfort because we had this kind of macro level safety where I knew he wasn't out to undermine me, for example. He was just out to try and get the best experiment that we could.
Yeah. I think about it. And I think about, though, so there's the people that feel safe to speak up, but it's also helping the people that already feel safe to speak up, aware of their own behaviors that stop other people, like how to put the barrier for the, you know,
trying to solve our big issue here.
That's true, whether it's in diversity, equity, inclusion, or just dominant personalities in a meeting and they stay dominant. And a lot of it is because they're so stressed that I've got to win my point. And that interrupts any sort of, wait a minute, hey, we want to come up with the best solution. That's not, this is the best solution. I've already decided we have to do it. And
it would be like trying to come up with an experiment in behavior science to really work against bias and figure out the bias. And it would have to be a pretty clean way to figure out the bias so that that you could really begin to look at it.
Talk about that.
I agree completely. I think this actually segues nicely into the idea of behavioral design. Like you want to design the environment to get the behavior that you want, right? So in this case, if we're talking about a meeting and making sure that we're getting all sides getting a chance to input and maybe, let's say, stopping the more domineering folks from hogging the mic. Behavioral design is exactly how I think you achieve this. I think in a lot of companies, I've seen this, meetings tend to be very unstructured, right? Like at the best, you might just have an agenda that has, here's three talking points we've got to cover today. But when you get more specific and design for things like, no, every speaker has 3 minutes, for example, or when you do things like you include the ability for people to, one simple thing that I saw, which was very nice, I used to give talks at the European Commission. You're representing your country there, right? So there's this kind of like profound sense of, I want to be respectful of other countries, but also I need to get my point across, right? I'm here representing my country. And one simple thing they do, which is very nice, is they give you a little placeholder with your name on it. And if you want to speak, or particularly if you want to interrupt someone, you just turn it up on its side so it's vertical, which is a really nice, clear signal to the room of, hey, I want to speak. And so like these kind of small environmental, like behavioral design elements can help empower people to speak up or to stop people who like to take advantage of their power hogging the mic.
Yeah. We've actually done that where we have disparity in vocal. Is we actually bring them up and they have a partner. And usually if I'm a soft spoken and you're more domineering, we'd be partnered up and you would give me feedback, but we have them three in and three out. So you're actually, it's a structure where, and then the others that are really vocal are like, wow, I wouldn't have even heard that. But where did that come from? Because they're just listening. They're listening and watching their other partner and giving them feedback.
But they like to feel like they're doing something important. So if they can actually get, if you're watching that person and helping them, that's going to help you get to a better solution. But it's the same idea. Somehow interrupt the, and then if that's not being paid attention to, that's information.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's very nice.
We do that with our Congress or
Any other team dynamic pieces, just because that's where you've done behavioral designs or heard about them and want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing I think is really useful, maybe two things. One is this idea that we call adversarial collaboration. It's an idea that's been borrowed from kind of academia. And so for example, like you might have two very famous academics who completely disagree with each other about this particular theory. And the old model was, I'll write a paper without ever talking to you and I'll design the perfect experiment. And then we'll just go off and you'll write your reply paper 6 months to a year or maybe even longer more. And then we'll just continue this cycle forever, right? We'll just argue back and forth without ever talking. The newer model of this kind of adversarial collaboration is, no, let's get together and agree a set of things that we can agree on. So this is the theory we want to test. The best way, if we had an ideal world, will be to test it this way. And then let's design the experiment together, taking your critiques of my approach on board and my critiques of your approach on board, run the experiment together, and now let's see the answer that we get. And we actually do this with companies sometimes. So you can imagine, like, in a very large company, right? You might have two different product teams who have very different opinions about how to achieve exactly the same goal, to maximize some KPI or something. And we say, okay, great, let's run an experiment. Let's have a bit of friendly competition here, right? We can even take a bet on it if you want. And we say, okay, let's test all of these things. We'll do whatever you were doing before. That can be the control. So team one gets to test their idea. Team two gets to test their idea. And then ultimately, the science kind of tells us who is right, with what's most effective. I think this is like a really nice approach that product teams can take to resolve conflict in a healthy way while also learning what's effective and what's not.
Yeah, I love that. That's basically how we operate our business most of the time, because we have very different approaches to whatever we're doing. And it's okay. Although we don't always get to experiment in quite the same fashion. One of us gets to try our idea one time and the other one gets to try it next time. And then I love all that you're having, like, with those two,
taking the academics and then instead having the conversation, because there's so much that you think when there's two people having this dialogue, you think, oh, they're not changing at all. But inevitably, we're influencing each other's point of views, and you see something else emerge down the road. I love, though, designing the what do we agree on? Let's design an experiment. We'll test it. And I imagine if that didn't come up with the right results, you design a different experiment, more leaning towards person B, and test it. Yeah,
that's the idea. I think we've been lucky in the fact that the clients that we work with, we usually try and get people to commit beforehand to say, look, okay, so if team two wins, what are we going to do? What are the steps? We try and pre-commit. I think in the academic space, sometimes we can say, okay, we just need another paper. We just need to run another study.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I could talk to you all day, Carl. It's very interesting. It's definitely what we are trying to do without all the experiments of that, because it's all these human dynamics that we're doing. Why don't you let people know if there's any final thoughts or how people can learn more about you and your company?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think for final thoughts, if you're a company that's out there who are facing some of these problems, who have different product teams with different ideas about how to meet the same goal, do get in touch with us. We're happy to run experiments with you and test these ideas, and let's see who wins out. And if you're interested in getting in contact, we've got a contact form on our website. It's www.irrationallabs.com.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you. I'm glad behavioral science is getting more utilized in the business arena, because I think it really works.
Yes.
Me too.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you found today's episode valuable. We know you're busy, and we want to make it easy for you to understand how conflict may be showing up in a way that's impacting your team negatively. We recorded the first three chapters of our book for you to listen to for free.
Get your free audio sample at thriveinc.com/free sample. That's thriveinc.com/FREESAMPLE.